Jesus once told a story that has to do with what we're going to be talking about today and kind of about that memory verse that we just read, but it was about the wise man built his house upon the, and the foolish man built his house upon the, and when the big bad wolf came and huffed and puffed, which one stood? The one on the rock, right? The brick house, yeah. But even if it's a house made of brick and it's built on the sand, it's going to fall, right? So it's the foundation. And what is the foundation that Jesus in that story said is how you know whether or not your house will stand? What is the good foundation? Not just rock, but what does it mean metaphorically? It's Jesus' teachings. The man who builds his house upon Jesus' teachings is the wise person who builds his house upon the rock. And so that, I think, has overlapping concepts with this. We're not covering that passage. We're covering a different passage today out of Matthew chapter 8, if you'd like to turn there. But in our sermon series right now, we are covering all the passages that involve this Greek word, alagapistoi. I still have the accent in the wrong spot. It's alagapistoi. That little mark is the accent mark, and so alagapistoi. And it is the compound plural vocative word for y'all little faiths. That's what it means. And so it's a little faith. Pistoi is faith, but oi is plural, so it's faiths. And it's OU, it's vocative. So that's what the word. So that's why that one Greek word in our English translations is often OU of little faith, or if you like King James, O ye of little faith. Some of the modern translations are dropping the O and it's just you of little faith. And so you can translate it different ways. There's some freedom there because it's one word in the Greek, right? And so you can have some freedom in how to choose to record that. But Jesus uses that word four times in the Gospel of Matthew. He uses it once in the Gospel of Luke, but it's one of those times that's used in the Gospel of Matthew. It's kind of like, oh, bless your heart is how I like to think of it. Because it's, oh, you have little faith. You only have little faith. It's kind of like that. And I think it's similar language to, oh, bless your heart. You poor person. I think of it that way. It's not always like that. Jesus, when he uses it, he's stating a fact. He's saying, you have little faith. He's not being a jerk. He's not trying to mock. He's just saying, oh, you have little faith here. Last week, we covered two of the four times that Jesus uses that word. The first and the last time Jesus uses the word. Both times were not, he said, don't be anxious. You have little faith. If you are anxious and you're worrying about what you're going to eat or what you're going to eat or drink or what you're going to wear, those are the things you don't need to worry about. God's going to have those things taken care of. This week, Jesus is going to use that word, O ye of little faith, when his disciples approach him because they're genuinely concerned about whether or not they're going to survive the next 5 minutes. And so that's the story that we're going to look at in this passage today. I'm going to get the whole story because context is key. It's very important for reading. So we're going to read the story before that story and the story after that story, but they all are interrelated, I think, and they're all three short stories, and so it won't take too long to cover them. So Matthew chapter 8, in the Pew Bibles, if you don't have a digital Bible or your own Bible, it's page 813. If you'd like to turn there. Matthew 8, verse 18 through 34. Now, when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And a scribe came up and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Another of the disciples said to him, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." And Jesus said to him, "Follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead." And when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great storm on the sea so that the boat was being swamped by the waves. But he was asleep. And they went and woke him, saying, "Save us, Lord, we are perishing." And he said to them, "Why are you afraid, O you of little faith?" Then he rose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was great calm. And the men marveled, saying, "What sort of man is this that even winds and sea obey him?" When he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him, coming out of the tombs so fierce that no one could pass that way. And behold, they cried out, "What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now a herd of many pigs was feeding at some distance from them, and the demons begged him, saying, "If you cast us out, send us away into the herd of pigs." And he said to them, "Go." So they came out and went into the pigs, and behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the waters. The herdsmen fled, and going to the city, they told everything, especially what had happened to the demon-possessed men. And behold, all the city came out to meet Jesus. And when they saw him, they begged him to leave their region. Three seemingly unrelated stories, except perhaps the context of Jesus getting on and off a boat. That's the kind of narratival way of connecting these stories, except for that's how it happened. Jesus starts by getting in a boat. It seems to escape the crowd of people who are wanting more and more miracles from him. He's interrupted as he's getting to the boat by two men. He answers them shortly, and the disciples take off. While they take off and are crossing the Sea of Galilee, a storm, well, the storm doesn't interrupt Jesus' sleep. The disciples interrupt Jesus' sleep, and they wake him up. He calms the storm, and they keep sailing. They get to the boat dock. It's actually, archaeologically, it's a really big pier. A lot of people, when they think of this image, they think of Jesus, like, beaching his boat. No, it's actually a really big pier in a man-made harbor that they reenacted a naval battle inside of. And so this is like a major dock that Jesus is pulling up. That means nothing for the passage, but that just stuck out in my head right now. And so Jesus pulls up alongside this pier, gets out of the boat as he's walking onto the shore. These two demon-possessed men run up to him. Jesus casts out the demons, and that's the end of the stories. So that's the really quick overview of what just happened, the really fast summary, but a lot more happens in those verses. The four verses before where I started reading reveal that Jesus has actually been performing miracles all day long. He started off at Peter's house, performs a miracle there, and just more and more people show up needing and wanting more and more miracles. It's getting to be the evening. Jesus sees the crowd and he says, "Let's get in the boat and go to the other side." It seems like he's saying, "Okay, I have to call it at some point. There's no end to the miracles here." He doesn't say that, but that's kind of what I think of when I see this passage. He says, okay, I have to call it. Let's get in the boat. Before he gets in the boat, we see that a scribe walks up and says, "I'd like to follow you, Jesus." Jesus warns him, though, that following him means a life of hardship. Shelter and rest are not guaranteed. In fact, with Jesus, you don't get that. Another disciple asks, "Don't leave yet, Jesus. Let me go bury my father first." Now, it's odd that that person is considered a disciple. It says another disciple says this. So the person's already a follower of Jesus, but he's saying, "Hang on, Jesus, I need to go bury my dead dad before you can leave." Jesus responds with, "The dead can bury their own dead. I'm getting in the boat." That's how Jesus says it here. It sounds really harsh from Jesus to say that, right? We always think of Jesus as like the nicest, most lovable, soft person, but actually he's very short and to the point sometimes with people. Scholars and commentators will read this passage and they try and soften the blow of Jesus' words oftentimes. There's a good chance because of how much faith or how much family was put first in the Jewish culture. There's actually a pretty good chance the dude's dad wasn't even dead yet. And he's saying, "Jesus, wait, I would love to follow you, but as a good Jewish son, I can't leave my father behind. Let me stay with him and wait until I bury him and then I can follow after you." That's one way of reading it. It's not necessarily what's in the text, but that's one way to soften the blow. Another way to soften the blow is the man might have said, "Wait, Jesus, let me finish the burial ceremony with my dad," which would have been a year after he died. So the way burials worked for families that were wealthy enough to afford a tomb back then is you would lay the dead body on in, like, there'd be a ledge right inside of the tomb. You'd leave the body there. It gets embalmed and things like that. And then a year later, you'd go and collect the bones and put them inside of an ossuary jar and then put that jar in the back of the cave with all the other jars from your family heritage that are filled with all the other ossuary jars. And so this is actually what would have happened to Jesus. They put him inside of a stone slab inside the tomb, and a year later would have come and collected the bones and put them into an ossuary jar, except that Jesus rose from the dead after 3 days. So they couldn't do that part. That plan was interrupted, and that's a good thing. That's how it worked back then. And so he might have been saying, "Jesus, I would love to, but my dad's dead right now. I need to finish burying him. I can't miss that opportunity." It's a kind of nice long-term way of bringing closure to things. And so he said, "I can't miss that opportunity." And are either one of those true? I have no idea. That's just us guessing to try and make Jesus not sound as much like a jerk. But here's the thing. I don't think Jesus cared if he sounded like a jerk. He was making a pretty good point. Let the dead bury their own dead. I'm here now. It's me. I'm Jesus, the Messiah. I'm going across the lake. This is a big deal here. When Jesus says it's time to go, you don't argue and say, "You know what? I really need to put my affairs in order first, and then I'll go ahead and follow you, Jesus." Jesus knows your affairs aren't in order, and that's why you probably should follow Jesus. Right? That's how it works, is you should follow Jesus because you know your affairs aren't in order. So it's not, "Hang on, let me take care of things, Jesus." It's Jesus saying, "No, let me take care of things. Let's go." That's kind of how this works here. And we also know that faith, our family came really, really high in the Jewish culture, so much that if you had a dead relative, It was expected that you were no longer obligated to say the Shema daily. The Shema was, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You should love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength." That good Jewish people said multiple times each day. But if you were mourning for a dead relative, you weren't even expected to say that. It was family before faith. Jesus, on this occasion and several other occasions, says, no, it's faith before family. Jesus is more important here. Now, we don't get their answers, and we don't know what exactly those two disciples said from this passage in Matthew. The scene changes too suddenly. We get to the next set of verses. They're on the boat in verse 23. I'll read it again. When he got into the boat, the disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great storm on the sea so that the boat was being swamped by the waves. But he was asleep. And they went and woke him, saying, "Save us, Lord, we are perishing." And he said to them, "Why are you afraid, O you of little faith?" Then he rose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. And the men marveled, saying, "What sort of man is this that even winds and sea obey him?" It says, and behold, there arose a great storm on the sea. It was enough to scare the disciples who were Jesus. Of the disciples that we know what career they had before they start following Jesus, what was the most predominant career, if you know? And were these types of fishermen that stood in the water, like waiting in the water, stood in the shore, were these boat type of fishermen? Boat fishermen. So these fishermen are career sailors, and they are scared of a storm, which means how big of a storm is this? A really big storm if your professional career is being on a boat, and now you're scared that you're on a boat during a storm. That's kind of a big deal here, right? In fact, it's actually such a big storm that the word there is not storm. The Greek word for storm is a different word, and it's not used in this passage once. The Greek word that's actually used when we translate in our English translation storm is the word seismos. What word does that sound like? Seismic. What does the word seismic mean? Somebody already yelled it. Means earthquake. That's what this word means. The word seismos is used 14 times in the New Testament. 13 of those times we translate in our English translations as earthquake. This one time we say, you know, it can't be an earthquake, it must be a storm. Well, I don't have a clue what an earthquake would look like on the Sea of Galilee, but that's how it's described in the actual language here. And it's described as a large earthquake. I don't know what an earthquake looks like on the Sea of Galilee, except that it was scary, right? So maybe it's their thing, their whole world is shaking. In the psalm, the passage that we started off the service with was from Psalm 107, and that was way long before this, but there's definitely allusions to this story, right? And it says, the sailors were stumbling around like they were drunk because they couldn't walk straight, and the boat was going up to the heavens and down into the grave. And so that's the image that you're getting of how big these waves are. And here in Matthew's story, the water's pouring into the boat, and these men who have lived on the sea their whole lives are panicking, and we get the note that Jesus was sleeping. Okay, Jesus. Guess you were tired. Miracles take it out of you, huh? Like I'm curious what they were saying about Jesus at this time. Have you ever been really, really busy or stressed out about something, and maybe your spouse at home is taking a nap, and you're like, we have to clean the house before the next hour and company comes? Has that ever happened? I've been the napping person before. and since I was asleep, I don't know what my wife said, but she probably said all nice things because my wife is awesome. But have you ever been like really aggravated at the napping person in your home because they should be working? And it's maybe something like that was going on here. And Jesus rubs his eyes after the Lord save us, we're gonna die here. He rubs his eyes. Why are you so afraid? Meanwhile, there's a storm going on that is so big they decided we can't use the word storm to describe this. We're gonna say something else. And they say, Jesus, I mean, how would you have answered when Jesus asked, why are you so afraid? And the boat is, you know, doing this. I've been in a boat at sea during a storm. It was on a cruise ship, and the wave was so big that I just kept walking. I was walking upright, but this is the pitch I was walking at compared to the room, and then I walked back like this. And then we went up to the top deck, and all of the furniture was all on one side of the boat. Like, that sort of thing happens, and I can't imagine that on a little tiny boat. I physically can't think about how scary that would be. And Jesus goes, why are you so afraid, guys? You have little faith. Yeah, so I don't know how I would have responded to Jesus there. The disciples aren't fully sure who Jesus is yet. They did spend the day before with Jesus, you know, that whole day of miracle working. They saw Jesus perform miracles the entire day long. And so they know he's something special, but I guess it is something to say, okay, I can heal a broken leg versus, you know, I can control the weather. And so maybe they didn't think that could be happening here. I mean, I've been woken up by my children at night, and the phrase, "Why are you so afraid, oh you of little faith," has never come out of my mouth. But I have said, "Oh, why are you afraid? We're in a safe house. We're protected here. It's okay," when my child wakes me up in the middle of the night. And so Jesus says, "Why are you afraid?" to these grown men, though. But then he commands nature. To be fair, though, this earthquake storm thing, whatever it is, and whatever you want to call it, most likely would have reminded the disciples of something even more scary. The common worldview at the time is that the sea, when it's chaotic, reminds you of the abyss. The abyss is an ancient worldview word for where demons come from. Like, that's the abyss is the home of the demons. The ancient peoples back then, this isn't how Genesis describes it, but many people would have thought of it like this back then, is that when Jesus establishes order into the world, it's to fight and keep back chaos. And chaos is the stormy, churling waters and winds where the demons come from, because they're all chaotic and the water and the deep and all that's scary. That's what they would have been thinking of. So they would have possibly, a storm that big that scares the minds of people who live on the water, they would have been thinking this is demonic in nature. This is the abyss coming to swallow us up. Maybe evil is upset because Jesus was just healing people all day long. And so now they're worried. And Jesus says, "Are you of little faith?" He calms the storm and they ask, "What just happened?" That's what takes place here. Now, I don't really know if the storm was demonic in nature, but then you turn not even one page, you go to the next sentence, and then here is something that is demonic in nature. The very next verses, verse 28. When he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him, coming out of the tombs so fierce that no one could pass that way. And behold, they cried out, "What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now a herd of many pigs was feeding at some distance from them, and the demons begged him, saying, "If you cast us out, send us away into the herd of pigs." And he said to them, "Go." So they came out and went into the pigs, and behold, the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the waters. The herdsmen fled, and going into the city, they told everything, especially what had happened to the demon-possessed men. And behold, all the city came out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they begged him to leave their region. Now, the same story is told in the Gospel of Mark, and it's told in the Gospel of Luke, and we get some extra details about this demon-possessed. And Mark and Luke only tell us about one of the men. Matthew tells us about both of the men that were there, but we get more details about this. The men were chained up frequently, but they kept just breaking out of the chains and terrorizing people. Also, in these stories from Mark and Luke, we get the name of the demon that's possessing these men, and the name is Legion. The name Legion is not a name from back then. It's a word that describes a part of the Roman army. It was a fighting force of 3,000 to 8,000 men. That's what a legion is. And so if you say, "What's your name?" and he says, "I'm army," that means they're looking for a fight, right? Like, if you say, "Hey, what's your name?" and like a veteran who's really gruff and burly tells you his I'm forgetting the word, his squad, that's not the right word, but you know what I mean? I'm really failing right here. His battalion, that's the word I'm looking for. That's not in my notes. His battalion, and says, "Yeah, this is who I am." And it's like, oh, I'm going to back up here, right? Like, that's what Legion is saying when Legion responds and is talking to Jesus. Even though this demon knows that Jesus is the Son of God, because that's what he says. It's not weird that demons knew that. James says demons know exactly who God is and they're worried about it, right? And so, but this demon says, "I'm looking for a fight. What's up?" And so then the demon backs up, though, because Jesus doesn't back down, and the demon starts saying, please don't send me back to the abyss. That's actually what it said in Mark and Luke. It uses the word abyss. Please don't send us to the abyss, which what we just talked about is what the disciples most likely would have been thinking on the chaotic, stormy sea, is in the biblical words, we actually do have the abyss, and it's where demons are sent to be chained and tortured. It's the end of the demons. It's not the source of the demons. It's where they're stuck for eternity. And the demons are saying, please don't send us there. We know that's going to come. Just don't send us there yet. And they say, okay, if you are going to do something to us, you're going to cast us out of these men. There's some pigs. Can we go attack them instead? And Jesus goes, sure, go. And what happens to the pigs? The pigs immediately all kill themselves, right? That's what happens. The pigs are demon-possessed, and so they run off down this steep cliff, and they all die. And then, oddly enough, the people say, Jesus, get out of town. Like, he just sent this legion of demons back from where they came from. That's the idea. They sent them back into the abyss. The night before, right, the sea was chaotic and evil and filled with all this bad stuff, and they just got sent back to from which they came. and the townspeople like, get out. Could have to do with Jesus just ruined their economy. Might have to do with that. But also, it might have to do with the fact that Jesus is a scary guy. If you notice how many times when he has to remind people, don't be afraid, that's because people were afraid. Jesus is not like always the cute, meek, and mild Jesus who's soft and cuddly and squishy. He's God who by his mere presence can kill sinners because we are sinners. Like, so you have to remember that about Jesus too. He was a scary guy and he had a giant target painted on his back throughout his whole life, right? Like, what's the first thing we learn about Jesus when he says, okay, it's time to start my ministry? Satan goes off and tempts him directly and shows up in person. And so Jesus has a big old target on his back. It would have been scary walking around with Jesus, I think. And so Jesus often says, do not be afraid. That said, though, it's still a sad world that prefers the life of pigs to the life of Jesus. But that's what happened in this town. Now, we might worry about, okay, Jesus just destroyed a ton of private property here. Like, we might be thinking about that and worried about that. But remember, the deadly destination of the pigs was the deadly destination of those two demon-possessed men. I mean, that's eventually what would have happened to them. They would have died from that. They were being forced to torture themselves for the life, if you read the descriptions of who they are in the other passages. And remember back to the storm at sea, these pigs floating in the water all dead, that's the mental image that you should be getting of that was almost Jesus and his disciples. They were almost all floating in the water dead. And so if I have to pick between Jesus and his disciples, two men who as far as we know are innocent, or a bunch of pigs, I know it's sad, but we should let the bacon go. Because people are more important than pigs. They just are. And so it's okay that this happened here. And so what do we learn from all of this, though? What on earth are we supposed to get from this passage? What is the point of Jesus even saying to his disciples, oh, you of little faith, oh, bless your heart. If their lives really were on the line at the end of the story, you get the image of what could have been the disciples floating there in the water. Their lives really were at risk in this situation. There was a risk of them being thrown into the chaotic abyss-like water here. And the disciples were seemingly right to wake Jesus up and say, help us, Lord, we're all gonna die. So what do we learn from this passage? And so I think we can learn some of it from that first. I'll read that first part of the passage again, verse 18 through 22. When Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side. A scribe came up and said to him, teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Another of the disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. And when it comes to following Jesus, life and death really are on the line. And we're over here worried about whether or not we're going to have a place to lay our heads. We're worried possibly about those already dead. We can't change whether or not someone's dead, right? You can't. The person's dead. We're worried maybe about storms and nature and things completely beyond our control. Maybe we're even worried about evil forces and an army of legion out to get us. But when Jesus says, let the dead bury their own dead, I think it's Jesus saying, let things out of your control stay out of your control because they're out of your control. What good is it to sit there and be constantly worried about someone who's already died? About whether or not you're actually safe, because guess what? You're not on this earth. And whether or not you have shelter, you can do all you want to make your house safe. It's still not 100% safe. Why are you worried so much about the weather? You can't control that. Why are you worried so much about demons? You can't control them either. Like, there's even going to be evil in this world. Hey, guess what? There's evil in this world. There's not, but there's evil in this lifetime. And so when Jesus says, let the dead bury their own dead, I think he's saying, quit worrying about what's outside of your control. Let's worry about the living right now. That's what we need to focus on. Because you know what all of those things have in common? The nature and evil and safety and death. All those things have in common, they are beyond our control. You can't do anything about those things. Now, you can take some precautions. Like maybe you should probably have life insurance, right? Like that's a good idea. You should probably go see a doctor if you have a heart condition, right? Various things like that. You can do some things. Maybe you should lock your door if like there's an issue like that. There are some things that it's okay. Some of it is within your control. But overall, though, it's not in your control. You can't control all the aspects about it. It's not in your hands. But in whose hands is it? Sunday school answer time. Jesus. God, right? It is in his hands. The song says, got the whole world in his hands. Okay. But Revelation chapter 1, though, is a nice passage that kind of makes me think of this as well. Revelation chapter 1 is, as I've already mentioned, I think twice during the sermon, Jesus is not just meek and mild Jesus. He's super powerful Jesus. And Revelation chapter 1 is when super powerful Jesus is described. And so Revelation chapter 1 is a great book, a great passage to read. Whole book's a great book to read. But the end of that passage in Revelation 1, 17 and 18, it says this, when John is face to face with Jesus and he can't literally stand anymore. It says, when I saw him, I fell at his feet, though dead. But he laid his right hand on me, saying, fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. Jesus has the keys to that which is beyond our control. There are things in life more important than the things many of us wish we could control. And unless we get our priorities straight, then we're the ones of little faith. We're the ones that are, oh ye of little faith. The ones that Jesus maybe looks at and says, oh, bless your heart. Why? Because if we don't get our priorities right and realize that we need to stop worrying about the things completely beyond our control, then we're just simply focusing on that which we have no authority or power over. And so why are we worrying about those things? But here's the good news, really good news. When Jesus is woken up on the boat and he sees the storm, did he panic? No. You know what he did after he calmed the storm? Here's my guess. It doesn't say it in the text, but I'm pretty confident of this. He went back to sleep. I'm pretty confident of that one. If you've got little kids, if you've ever had little kids, and they wake you up because of a storm and you finally get them settled, what do? You go back to sleep because you know you're safe. So Jesus, I'm willing to bet he calmed the storm and went back to sleep. He was not worried about the storm. It was just like, okay, situation's over. I can go back to bed now. That's what I think Jesus did. When Jesus was woken up by those he called little faith, did he say, you know what? I can't help you. I'm not going to help you guys. What did he do? He pointed out the fact they've got little faith, and then he calms the storm. He says, shut up, storm. Says he rebukes it. So that's what I think there. He probably didn't say shut up because it wasn't a word back then. But he rebukes the storm, says, calm down, storm. It calms down. And then he probably went back to sleep. And you know what? That means it's okay that they woke him up and said, save us. We're going to die, Jesus. Which means it's okay if you have little faith. Right? Because Jesus still helped them. He didn't say, oh, ye of little faith, I'm going back to bed. That's not what happened. He said, oh, ye of little faith, calms the storm. And then either goes back to bed or stays awake and comforts them. I don't know. One of those things. But he doesn't just say, yep, too bad. You have a little faith. Sorry, guys. That's not what happens. He helps them out. And so when the storms of life assail us and we're tempted to focus on over which we have no power, what are we to do? Maybe it wouldn't hurt to admit that we only have a little bit of faith and we ask Jesus for help. And you know, here's the thing. It's not a bad thing to admit that we only have a little bit of faith because Jesus said faith the size of a mustard seed can make mountains dance. How many of you can command mountains, right? Like, I can't. Honestly, I've never told a mountain to jump in the sea, but maybe I should try. I don't know. But I think we all have a little bit of faith. Every single one of us in this room only has a little bit of faith as far as comparisons go. And so Jesus is not making fun of us for saying we have a little bit of faith. Saying, I acknowledge you have a little faith. I'm going to help you. And that's what happens in this passage. God knows the size of your faith more than you do. And if you call out to him because you think you're perishing, maybe he's resting because he knows you're not perishing. But if you call out to him and ask for help, he'll probably help you. If nothing else, he'll be near you and comfort you as you wait on him. And so what do you do if you realize, oh, it's not just, oh, ye of little faith, it's, oh, me of little faith. I'm that guy. That's okay. You acknowledge it. As the man who approached Jesus said, I want to believe, help me in my unbelief. It's like that. Say, God, I know I have little faith. Really want you to help me out here. And the example we get from this story is God says, yeah, you've got little faith, but I'm going to help you out. That's what we see in this passage. If you realize you're focusing on the wrong things that you cannot change, you have no control over these things, then here's what you do. as the song written 101 years ago. It's, turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of this earth will go strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. And that's what you do. Or as Hebrews put it, probably where the song came from, fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. Not worried about all the things that trip us up, but instead focusing on Christ. Jesus did not say that in this world we won't have trouble. He actually said, in this world you're going to have trouble. But then he said, but take heart, I have come to overcome the world. That's who Jesus is. Have faith that he has the power to rebuke the storms in your life. Be willing to follow him through the things that may even make your faith seem small, like tragedy from the weather or from life and death. Those can make your faith seem small. But you don't stop focusing on who Jesus is. Knowing, thankfully, that Jesus works with even the smallest of faiths. Going back to last week's OU of Little Faith, it's don't be anxious. God is on your side, and he's powerful. In fact, the winds and the sea even obey him. And so keep focused on Jesus, even when we're distracted and want to focus on these things that we can't control. Focus on Jesus instead. We can't control him, but we can control where our eyes are looking. So please pray with me. Father in heaven, we are thankful that you are a God who works with little faith. We ask that you work with ours. May we, even though we can admit that we are O me of little faiths, that instead, that we keep our eyes fixed on you. So God, we ask this, help increase our faith, help us to know you more and more. Help us to not be whirled in the many storms of life all around us. We ask us not to be distracted by that which we have no power over, but instead to be focused solely on you, the author and perfecter of our faith. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.